Welcome to the Hot Stove Society Radio Show. Tom Douglas.
Terry Roth, your other chef in the hat.
Are your host today. Madeline Dow, our producer, sitting in the wings. Sean, our videographer and sound man, is sitting at the board here today. Thank you all for joining us. We're here for two straight hours. Last week I was listening to the show, and we, you know, in the past, you know, that we our show's from 4 to 6 on Saturdays. And 5 to, you know, usually it was only an hour, but this last week I listened and we were on for all 2 hours of our show. So
nice.
Turns out I lost the food trivia challenge on both Saturday and Sunday.
Oh, both days.
We're thankful that you joined us. I am chef owner of a few restaurants here in Seattle, including the Seattle Serious Takeout out in Ballard at 52nd and 14th Northwest. That's probably our newest one. Plus, we have a couple of our older restaurants open for a shortened schedule and for a little bit of business here at Serious Pie downtown and C-Town in the Pike Place Market area. And, of course, the Hot Stove is open. We're doing virtual cooking classes. So if you want to know more about those, just go to hotstovesociety.com.
And I have Luke in Madison Valley. Patio dining is getting shorter and shorter by the day.
We have heaters. You can see the leaves turn right now.
We have heaters. We don't have covers. We're thinking about it, but I don't know. Right now, at least, we have heaters. So patio dining and indoor dining. And now, the good news from the governor is we can take parties of 6 instead of 5.
Yeah. Awesome.
We just made it complete 3 couples.
And I don't think they have to be all family members anymore either. So that's good news.
That's a good news, yes.
You know, it's good that you have those patio heaters because they are now the new shortage.
Yeah,
outdoor heaters are in short supply.
Right. I have one for sale for 3 times the price if anybody's interested. No, just kidding.
Any way to make a buck. You put it in a box with 2 hamburgers.
Right now, it's anything we'll sell.
Exactly. Oh, my. It's Terry, I've got some, in our next segment, we've got some Bristol Bay salmon to eat. So just give that a double check. It just got up to temperature. It was frozen when I put it in. So check that out. Yes, I put in frozen Bristol Bay sockeye salmon.
I think it's ready.
Good. Here's a towel.
Thank you.
We're going to try that in the next segment. It smells so good. I can't wait. I just put butter on it, a little salt and pepper. And as it sits there, I'm sure it'll finish cooking. We got a big show today. We're continue with our Seafood 101. Andy Wink and Francis Bursch are here from the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association. Excited to talk to them. Get caught up on where the Pebble Mine stands, where the salmon run is, the largest sockeye salmon run left on Earth. It's our Pass It Down segment. Maddie actually got on the phone, and you talked with somebody about this time. You got some tape for us.
I do. It's wonderful. It's in her own voice, a wonderful, beloved grandmother's recipe for pot roast and drippings and noodles, and it's awesome.
Sounds
super fun.
Delicious. You know, we got another segment that I'm anxious to talk about today, too. Later on in the show, in the second hour, we're going to talk about cities that we miss traveling to. Both Terry and I were world travel hoppers before this all started.
That should put a break on that.
Yeah, I did. I haven't been on a commercial plane in 6 months. I used to take between 3 to 5 trips a month. So.
Oh, yeah, you used to travel all the time.
Yeah,
so.
It's very interesting. I've been on a few, you know, a couple of friends have actually invited me on a few golf trips on their private planes, which is super fun, got to say that.
That it's good is to have definitely fun. Yes.
Good to have friends with jets. Because I certainly can't afford one. So we're going to talk about New Orleans today. I'd like to get some of your reflections on visits to that fine
city. Laisse le bon temps rouler.
And then Maddie said you were perusing online because you have the travel bug too, and you found a couple of places that you can't wait to try that I've never even heard of. So I'm looking forward to that. What else do we have today? Lauren Coe is here with her new book, Pyometry. And, of course, we're going to wrap up the show at the end of our 2 hours with the Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge.
Which today?
There's no doubt our new producer's goal in life is to make me go 0-for-5 every week. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be interesting how we deal with that. I'm going to have to read up or something. Our Taste of the Week. What is something that you enjoyed this week, Chef?
Well, last night was, by the way, big shout-out to my two all oldest son, Ryan. It's his 30th birthday today.
Yay.
30 years ago, I was in Oz, and I was flying about 10 feet off the ground at this time of the day because he was born. Mm-hmm. And that was the firstborn, and that was quite a high for about 24 hours. Unbelievable. Anyway, last night I made him dinner for his birthday. He wanted to have His request was mushrooms, veal sauce, and whatever else I wanted. And I know he loves sushi, and I know he loves raw fish. So
mushrooms and veal sauce on sushi sounds
fabulous. Whoa, hold on. Not together, obviously, Tom.
Oh, I didn't. Well, you just put them together.
No, we started with, I had a Columbia River coho that came in yesterday. Mm-hmm. So I took all the belly and made a tartare with that. I made a very simple soy, mustard, sesame seed oil kind of dressing. Chopped chives and a tiny bit of chili pepper. And mixed that together and made a beautiful tartare of salmon that was on toast just to stop the meal with a glass of champagne. That was, so simple and yet so delicious.
And you took the belly because that's the fattiest part,
right? Yeah. Yes, of course. I took the belly because because I know he loves that too. Every time we fight in our house for the belly of the salmon, when I bring the side, I cut the belly off. I go, man, this salmon didn't have any belly.
Right. Funny. Well, it's funny. My taste of the week is salmon also. And it's good that we're having Seafood 101 month here because, but I guess this might sound snotty, and I don't mean it to be at all, but I order a dish from our local Thai restaurant called Thai Siam up in the Crown Hill neighborhood. And it's probably my favorite COVID meal. So by that, I mean, since COVID's happened and we've been doing lots of takeout here and there, I order the salmon in the Red Sea, and I order the pad sayu with beef. And I get both dishes, and it gives me two meals at home. I split them up, and I have half and half each meal. But the salmon in the Red Sea is just a classic kind of Thai curry with coconut milk base. And I think the surprise, and where I'm probably being a little bit snotty, is that they use wild fish. They use wild salmon. And my guess is they're buying something like the Orca Bay frozen fillets or something that they keep in the freezer, and when somebody orders it, they just simply put it into a steamer. It's cooked all the way through, but it's got that beautiful bite of wild fish, that, you know, farm fish, you can tell. Right, it's just mush in your mouth.
You can tell the difference for sure.
Yes, for sure. And I'm really proud of them for using that fish. It's a delicious dish. It's got a base of spinach and peppers and bean sprouts and this beautiful broth of
curry,
red curry paste, coconut broth. So delicious. And with the wild fish, it just makes it, sends me over the top every time. And I want to say it's, you know, $20 or something like that. So,
and the name of the restaurant again?
Thai Siam. And it has become, you know, I eat it maybe once a month.
Right.
But that's 5 months in a row. That's unusual for me to go to a restaurant once a month for 5 months in a row or 6 months in a row.
Especially when you don't go out to many restaurants these days.
I go out to plenty. I know everyone else seems to be worried about that, and I probably should be, but I go out to plenty of restaurants. I take my care. I bring my sanitizer. I wear my mask. I do all the things. But I'm a restaurant head. I can't.
Yeah. I'm with you, Tom.
Yeah. It's just got to be what it is. On Cairo Radio 97.3 FM, it's the Hot Stove Society Show. Welcome back to the Hot Stove Society Show. Chef Rotaro, the chef in the chapeau.
That's right, Monsieur Tom Douglas.
Stage left.
Stage right is Douglas. Stage left is Rotaro.
That's right, exactly. I'm Tom Douglas, and we are happy to have you in our house right now. And hopefully we're in your house. We're in your garden. We're in your car. We are somewhere. Last week a friend told me I was in his shower. That made me feel a little freaky.
Right now, I hope you're pulling the flour out of the cupboard and decide, I'm going to make some pasta today.
I'm going to make a plum tart, maybe. Or some
plum tart or some pasta.
Or some pasta. Thierry.
Yes.
One dish pasta meals.
Chanterelle, a little pancetta or bacon in cube, like lardon, and a little cream, veal stock. Done. I got a beautiful pasta on my hand, and most likely fettuccine. So, you know, just one of those dish. This time of year, Tom, going into the woods, picking up chanterelle, or have someone else do it and bring them back to you, which is what we do well. We get pickers and whatever that come back to the back door and bring you those beautiful mushroom this time of year. And I think it's a celebration for me when I see the first chanterelle, the nice little buttons, fairly dry, especially at the end of this week. It's the first thing I think about. Saute those chanterelles in brown butter with some shallots, fresh thyme, salt, pepper, on the side, lardon, mix it together, a little dash of veal stock, put that in there, reduce it down, dash of creme fraiche, and then mix the whole thing with your fettuccine. Mm-hmm. And then you get this beautiful, and then, you know, a little bit of probably some Parmesan would be great. A nice little shaving of Parmesan, not grated, but just little sliver of Parmesan on there. So when I eat it, stick to the roof of my mouth at the same time as I'm eating it.
Mm. When you say lardons, you could do the classic French style where you kind of blanch the bacon, the pork belly, or yeah. Do you like my style where I make them kind of pan-fried crispy?
Yeah, I do. I start from the beginning. I start raw. I don't blanch it. I just start raw, just like bacon.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to color it very nicely on all sides, give it a nice sear, you know, and then remove it from the pan and use that fat to do sauté some shallots and add my chanterelle. Do all that together, and then put the bacon back in at the last minute.
So you can use sliced bacon, but if you want a true lardon, you kind of have to buy your bacon in a uncut,
unsliced. Yeah, you have to
and
buy
then
a piece.
And you can make it thicker make a kind of a. They're thicker than matchsticks, but the same kind of shape, but you know maybe two or three times the size of a matchstick.
Yeah, no, I mean
and
definitely,
that's a lardon.
Definitely, at least a half an inch square kind of idea.
I always, this time of year, think more vegetarian. It's funny because I don't often think that way. And you would think in the summer with all the plentitudes of fresh vegetables.
Yeah.
But I think when I think of one pot pasta meals, I love squash.
Mm.
Squash just, for some reason, it's fall. It just feels good. And I'll take a spoonful of spaghetti squash mm-hmm. or I'll take... A butternut squash, and I'll just cube it raw and then kind of saute it the same way you did the lardons of bacon. You can do the lardons or little chunks of butternut squash. And then there's an easy way to kind of perk that up and stick with the brown butter, but add some chili flake, add some toasted hazelnuts. And my favorite pasta for something like that is like orchietti, where you're not trying to get a big, long piece of linguine in your mouth or spaghetti, right? You can take the whole bit of squash, the nut, the chilies, and the piece of pasta all at the same time on one spoon. That's my idea in a one-pot pasta meal. I'll save the spaghetti for more traditional things like anchovy and chili with oregano or something.
You know what I like about the fettuccine or the large pasta like that?
The long pasta?
Well, the long and large. I like long and large pasta. I like the fact that you can take your fork and your spoon. I always eat pasta with a spoon. So I roll I twirl the
but don't
spaghetti.
You find when you have chunks of lardon or chunks of squash or something like that, it's hard to get that all.
So the trick is you pick with your fork. You pick the lardon. You pick the chanterelle. Then you turn.
You cheat.
That's
cheating. Italians would never do that. Only
Tom,
the French would.
When
do
I'm
that.
Eating, I'm never cheating. I'm eating.
What about this time of year? A technique. You know, we've put away so much tomato sauce this year.
Oh yeah,
we had an abundance of sauce tomatoes, and so we have our freezers at the farm are full, at our house are full, and now we've got 170 quarts at the at the warehouse kitchen of sauce, and. This is a technique that I think people forget about or have never been taught because to me it's more of grandma technique,
right?
Where you take your short rib or you take your pork shoulder chunk or I love using the country style pork chops
mm-hmm.
because that's the pork butt with the blade in it but cut into smaller pieces so the bone comes out more. And then you just braise it, you pan fry it, cook it, 3/4 of the way done, and then you braise it in the tomato sauce.
Finish in the tomato sauce. Yeah.
I love braising meat in tomato sauce, and I just don't think of people doing that very much.
Yeah, I think of that with lamb, you know, leg of lamb.
Uh-huh.
You cook and you roast your leg of lamb, like you just said.
You brown it.
To about medium rare to medium.
Okay.
Then you dice it and finish it in the tomato sauce.
What do you mean you dice it?
Well, you let it rest. I take the leg and I break it down into the different pieces. I do little portions.
After it's cooked?
No, beforehand.
Before, yeah.
And then I roast that. You know, first I marinated olive oil, a little fresh thyme, oregano. Then I sear that. Then I slice it or dice it. Then I put that in the tomato sauce, and I cook that for another 15 minutes of, gently cooking into that. And it imbibes the lamb with that tomato garlic sauce.
Mm. Yeah, it's just a technique that is... It's kind of lost in history, I feel. I mean, maybe I'm just crazy, but you can tell me if I'm just nuts. Just go to our page. People do it all the time. Go to our Facebook page. Turns out when I go on and I see all the negative comments about me, it's from our producer, Madeline.
She will tell you you're crazy. People are still doing that. They're still cooking in tomato sauce.
That same thing, just greens, right? Orchiette or penne or rigatoni or something with just sautéed kale or just sautéed ruby chard, olive oil, and then finish with breadcrumbs.
Right.
And so here's another one of my little rants, right? People often say, you use your old stale bread and make breadcrumbs. No, don't. Use fresh bread and make breadcrumbs, right?
Yes.
Just put a fresh bread into your food processor and whir it up, and it becomes breadcrumbs. Then saute those in olive oil and herbs and maybe a little crushed garlic, salt and pepper, and make delicious breadcrumbs.
Right.
Then after you've got your pasta all cooked, you've tossed it with the kale or the chard or whatever your greens is, lots of olive oil. This is an area I love to use that kind of they call it virgin pressed lemon olive oil or orange olive oil.
The good olive oil.
Well, it's good, but it's also it's pressed with the olives.
Right.
I just love that flavor.
Flavored, yeah.
And so with the kale and all that. But then you finish with these nice toasty breadcrumbs, which gives you a crunch. And to me, you've got virtually nothing into this.
Right.
But a meal. You get a meal out of it.
And if you still have 177 quarts of tomato sauce left, you could put some of that in there, too.
Uh-huh. And if you want a protein, just add chickpeas.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you can just add a bean of this or that, and now you've got a very balanced dinner.
That's where I would use my lardon, though. If I'm putting beans, I want lardon in that bean.
Damn, you just can't get away from it. You can't get away from it.
Oh, you can. Just not with the beans.
Up next, we've got Francis right here in the studio and Andy on the phone from the BBRSDA, which is Bristol Bay something. I'm sure I'm going to get that by the time we get back. On Cairo Radio, hot, the Hot Stove Society, 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Hot Stove Society radio show. Tom Douglas here in the studio at the Hot Stove Society.
And Thierry Roturo, the chef in the hat with his fishing pole.
With his fishing pole, and you're eating some Bristol Bay sockeye salmon. Mm. Chef, what do you think?
I think it melts in your mouth. I mean, it is, and I'm impressed by, you literally turn around, put it in the oven, and in less than seven minutes, so that's pretty impressive. Cooked.
Francis is here. Francis Birch is here. She's a program specialist with the BBRSDA, the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association. And Andy Wink is on the phone. He's the executive director. And we're going to talk a little bit about the status of Bristol Bay. So, Andy, why don't you lead us off here and tell us where Bristol Bay stands right now as far as Pebble Mine, as far as the season and how the fishing is and the management of the fishery and all of that sort of thing.
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks for having me on, first of all. And, you know, our organization, we represent Bristol Bay's commercial fishermen. And we're essentially a trade group, but we really seek to, you know, make the fishery as valuable and as sustainable as it can be. And, you know, things for Bristol Bay have been going pretty well outside of the threat of the Pebble Mine. Our fishermen caught around 40 million sockeye this year. That's down a little bit from last year, but it's still an above average harvest. That, you know, 40 million fish equates to about 200 million pounds in like round weight terms.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, another huge harvest, and we're really, you know, feel kind of blessed to have the harvest that we had this year, A, because of COVID. You know, there was questions about whether, you know, any fish were going to be able to be harvested at all. But the industry, you know, the fishermen, the processors, the local medical facilities, they did an amazing job. And, you know, this fishery brings in, you know, first of all, it's a very large fishery. It's the largest salmon fishery in the world. And it happens in a very remote area. So that means a lot of people are going out there to fish and, you know, catch fish, cut fish, do management activities, all the support workers. And so if you have, you know, 10 to 15,000 people coming into a remote area, you know, there's close quarters in some places. You know, it's all the things that make for a dangerous COVID situation. Yet we didn't have any community spread of the virus. We didn't have any hospitalizations, and of course, nobody died from it. So we're very happy with the way things turned out COVID-wise. A lot of planning went into making that a success. And now, you know, the world has a bunch of sockeye ready to be eaten.
40 million is a bunch.
It is. And, you know, like I said, we were fortunate this year because a lot of runs in other areas of Alaska and even, you know, across the Bering Sea over in Russia did not fare so well. Typically, Bristol Bay accounts for like 40 to 50% of the world's sockeye harvest. This year, it's probably going to be closer to two-thirds, maybe even 70%. So, you know,
so does those,
I guess, just kind of the...
Do those 40 million pounds go all over the world?
40 million fish.
Fish, pardon me. For 40 million fish, do they go all over the world or just stay in the U.S.?
No, they go all over the world. You know, Europe is a really big market. A lot of the sockeye there gets smoked and sold as smoked product. Japan is a huge market. But there's niche markets all over, you know, really anywhere else in the world. You know, it could be Middle East, it could be South Africa, South America, you know, Caribbean. You know, anywhere people are willing, you know, I guess, to pay up for high quality wild salmon, there's a good chance that Bristol Bay sockeye are going to be going into those markets just to feed consumer demand.
You know, that's one of the things we talk about all the time here at the Hot Stove with our teams and with our customers. Is about creating that economy around that fishery. You know, it needs to be well managed, sustainably managed, but you also need to create the economy around the fishery so that it has value. It can offer jobs in place of the strip mining that happens when the Pebble Mine gets a permit. So some people say, well, why are you catching all these fish? Well, if it's managed, it's one thing, but it's also so much better for our earth if we don't strip mine the heck or open pit gold mine and copper mine the heck out of a remote place like this.
There's simply no precedent for a mine the size and the type of Pebble and what's being proposed there coexisting with abundant salmon run. Mm-hmm. We just don't have any other scenario to point to say, well, it worked there. You know, maybe there's things we can learn from that. And I as long as I've been in this, this fight, I will never understand why we're, you know, some people are willing to roll the dice on something that, you know, is such a unique resource and employs, I mean, the fishery and all of the, you know, the processing workers and management workers. I mean, you're talking about 17 times more jobs than what the mine would directly create. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've heard people and, you know, people in positions of power, politicians, that things say, well, we don't want to trade one resource for another. But we don't have any precedent for anything other than having either a pebble mine or an abundant salmon fishery.
Right.
And you know, history tells us and logic that we can have one or the other, but not both.
And with
at this point in time.
With the mining executives caught on tape saying that this isn't just a one mine project. This has got hundreds of years worth of mining and large mining aspirations. There's no wool over the eyes anymore. We know exactly what their intentions are. They made it clear on tape. And my favorite part about that was they said, well, it was not ethical for them to be taped. Yet they're the ones sitting there lying. He's like, they're ethical somehow? Okay, let's jump over to Frances, who grew up set netting with her family in Pilot Point on the Ugashik River and has been commercial fishing for 9 years. She grew up in Homer and made the seasonal migration to Bristol Bay for fishing every summer. Her family is still involved in the fishery, and she's worked in the nonprofit sector and in direct marketing of Bristol Bay salmon. Welcome to the show, Frances.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us about your involvement in Bristol Bay and why it's so important to save it and what you're doing with the fish that you're catching now.
Absolutely. Like you mentioned, I've spent every summer of my life in Bristol Bay. Grew up in a set with my family's set net operation, mm-hmm. which is a shore-based fishery. And since then, I've worked on drift boats, which are similar, but living and working on the water. Mm-hmm. And the Ugashik River is one of the four main rivers in Bristol Bay, and very pristine, very, very remote place. It takes either days on a boat or several jumps in a bush plane to get out there. Mm-hmm. It's an important part of my life still, spending summers out there and Yeah, always in awe of the return of salmon. Holds a lot of reverence for the species and the protein and just the force of salmon in the world.
The force of nature.
Exactly.
I mean, if you watch the movies that we help produce, the Breach or The Wild, some of the video of those salmon returning by the millions to that area to spawn is just, it's overwhelming. You can't even believe it.
It is.
It's a beautiful process for sure. And there's not many, many other species that do that, go back to where they were born and, you know, spawn and do the circle of life. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
It is. It's, fishermen like to complain sometimes, like, oh, well, the salmon are a week late this year. It's like, this salmon's been in the ocean for 4 years and you're here saying it's a week late to one location.
Give them the Uber app.
Yeah.
One of the things I appreciate about your fleets out there on the water is that they do stand down and let the certain percentage of the fish go through, which helps, obviously, is part of the sustainability and management of that run. And that's really important that we don't just take all the fish, right? You have to, or else you'll have nothing come back in 4 years.
Exactly. And every day, people ask how many hours we fish a day, and it depends. Every day we tune into the AM radio to the local station and listen for the biologist to tell us if we can fish the next day and if so, for how long. So it might be, okay, fish 10 hours tomorrow, or it might be, listen on Wednesday. We were waiting to see some fish return to the lake.
I'll remind you, October is National Seafood Month to celebrate local fishing organizations, including the Port of Seattle, the Seattle Propeller Club, and have all joined together through the Seafood 101 campaign, the goals of which are to encourage folks to eat more seafood, right? That's an awesome possibility. And to highlight the commitment to sustainability and to celebrate the economic value of the maritime and fishing industries, which we know is, especially here in Seattle, for us, is great. Andy Wink, Executive Director, was joined us. Thank you, Andy. And Francis Birch, Program Specialist for the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association, for being here in studio. I can't, the fish that we just ate, so delicious. And I will say, I don't know if you saw, you brought that in fairly frozen. And I just popped it into a 200-degree oven, which was building to 500. But when I put it in, it was frozen and into a 200-degree oven with salt, pepper, butter, finished with lemon juice when it came out, and it took 7 minutes. And what was the important part about what we did, Chef? We let it rest.
Exactly. We let it sit right here for about 3 minutes and then go at it.
Yeah, so good. Up next, we have the Pass It Down. We have an interesting, fun, sweet, almost teary-eyed tape that Madeline produced for our next segment on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's the Hot Stove Society Radio Show. Welcome back, Chef.
Welcome back, Thomas.
It's the Hot Stove Society Radio Show. I'm Tom Douglas. Chef in the Chapeau is right here with me. And Madeline, our producer, gave a call to Kim Johnson, who shares her story and recipe of her grandmother's pot roast and noodle dish. You'll know that this segment came out of the idea that you need to pass down your recipe box, right?
And don't let it die with you.
Don't let it die with you. It's not just the recipe. It's not just the directions on how to make it. It's the family lore and history that goes with it, the traditions behind it, why it's important, and why you should make it important for your kids or for your nephews or whoever is left in your family to want to keep it.
That's right.
Enjoy it and tell the same stories to their kids. So let's jump in with Madeline and hear what Kim had to say about her grandma's recipe.
I just wanted to relay a great recipe that has been passed down in my family. It started with my grandmother, my dad's mom, and we all lived together in a multi-generational home. And so we got to have my grandmother cook for us quite a bit. And one of her favorite recipes, favorite of mine as well, was pot roasted noodles. And to my knowledge, I've never heard anybody else make this recipe. And you know, one of the things, I'm a native from Seattle. I mean, I grew up here my whole life, and I remember my grandmother going down to Pike Place Market and buying meat. And I'm sure that she probably went down there to buy her roast. She'd cook a pot roast just normally, you know, brown it on both sides, put garlic cloves in it, salt and pepper, and then put it in the oven and let it cook until it was done. But the treat was that she'd get up early Sunday morning. It was always a Sunday dinner thing. And she'd make homemade pasta, homemade noodles. And she would, you know, roll them out by hand with a rolling pin. And I always thought that she had this special noodle cutter, but what actually was, come to find out later, it was a parsley cutter, and you rolled it over your herbs to cut them up, and she used it to cut the pasta. She'd spread all the noodles out on a on the table on wax paper and leave them there to dry for the day. And then, of course, we'd be treated to them. She would take the pot roast out when it was done, and she would use either broth made from oxtails or a bouillon to add to the pan drippings. And then she'd cook the pasta in the pan drippings. Because the noodles had flour on them, it would kind of thicken the sauce, and so you would be left with these kind of luxurious saucy noodles to go with your pot roast. And I don't really remember if we had vegetables or salad with it or anything, because it was just the main thing was the pot roasted noodles and always horseradish with it. And it was just always such a treat. And occasionally, because we were multi-generational, somebody would show up for dinner unexpected, and there was always room. When my grandmother passed away, my mom, you know, pretty much took over all the cooking, and she added to the recipe. She and my dad both really like sautéed mushrooms, and so she would sauté mushrooms in the drippings before she added the broth and stuff. So there would be sautéed fresh mushrooms in the noodles. And then, you know, of course, my sister and I have always cooked the recipe. And one of the things that when my mom passed away, I inherited the roaster pan. And it was, I mean, this was from had to be from the 20s, 30s, something like that. It was cast aluminum. And it had lasted all these years. And it was always, you know, the pot roast pan. And so I had the pan. And my son and my two stepchildren grew up eating this. And so, and all of them, it was like, oh, we'll have that for our birthday dinner. We want that for, you know, some special occasion. And so then I finally broke down and bought a La Crusette roaster pan about the time my son was off to college, and I gave him the aluminum roaster pan. You know, I think he charmed a few girls with cooking pot roast and noodles. And then, you know, it's just, it's gotten carried on with all of our kids. My daughter lives in Ireland, and so when we went to visit, I had to introduce her husband to it. The best part of it, though, and I'm sure Tom and Terry are used to this, but went to a meat market in Ireland, and I always use a 7-bone roast because I like the bone in it. And I asked the butcher, you know, if he could cut it. Well, over there, their cuts of meat are different than ours, so I had to draw a picture of it. And he cut me this great, big, beautiful 7-bone roast. It was like, this is too much, you know. I wish I could go to the markets here and say, oh, wow, just cut me a piece of meat. And, of course, I got the history from him of where the cow had come from. I've never had anybody tell me that they didn't like it or to never make it again. So I feel pretty good about that. Long time ago, you know, I put together cookbooks for my kids and a friend of mine, and I'd always write in there some story about where I got the recipe and who was there and what we were doing at the time. And over the years, I've looked back at them, and it's just, it's brought back so many memories.
So, Madeline, that was so sweet. What did you take away from that after you heard her story?
It was awesome. I loved talking with Kim. You know, it's amazing that recipe has been passed down now to 4 generations.
That is so cool.
And transcontinental, right? So
She
talked about Ireland and having it made. And I also just love the fact that, you know, she has those visceral memories of that Sunday morning when her grandmother was making the fresh pasta and making the pot roast. You know, it's just like we were talking about. It's not just a recipe. It's about the sound memory and all of that.
And yeah. The pot. The pot was passed down all the way to her son.
Exactly. The pot too. So my favorite thing, she did comment in her original email. She says, the best compliment I've had is the only thing wrong with this dish is that you can't shovel the noodles in fast enough, which is mine.
All right, in our second hour, we're going to keep going. We're going to stay busy right here on the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.
It's time for hour two of the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo Radio. Tom Douglas here.
Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
And Terry, we've got a big hour coming up. We're going to talk to Lauren Coe, who's an artist, home baker, and author of Pyometry.
And I saw all her pictures on Instagram. Uh-huh. I spent probably 45 minutes looking at all those pies. I am blown away. If you have a minute to go to Instagram and look at her pies, it is definitely Artistry 101.
She has been getting lots and lots of press for a few years now about her beautiful pies.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk about our favorite cities that we are missing in the COVID era that we can't travel to, and maybe some of the places that we had been to over the past. This hour is going to be New Orleans. And Maddie, you said that you found some places when you were researching New Orleans that you can't wait to go to that we've never even heard of.
It's true. And now I'm really hungry.
I know, exactly. Finally, we're going to wrap up with our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge brought to you by Rub with Love. And as we mentioned before, October is National Seafood Month. And we wanted to emphasize that it's the perfect time to understand where wild and sustainable seafood comes from and that it's predominantly Alaska. The folks
especially
behind Alaska.
Huh? Especially in this part of the world, yes.
Yeah. Actually, and all over the world. The folks behind Alaska Seafood are helping create another reason to eat more fish with At Seafood Sunday, a new occasion to encourage people to enjoy wild seafood together. The idea is to choose seafood from Alaska for a Sunday breakfast, lunch, or dinner, either by ordering takeout or choosing fish at a restaurant or trying a new recipe to prepare at home. And so I've been doing that for quite a long time myself, personally. A lot of people just think of salmon when they think of Alaska seafood, but as you and I both know, it goes beyond that. And one of my favorite Alaska fishes is the black cod.
Yeah.
Generally, the colder the water, the better the fish. There's pollock, halibut, crab, sablefish, you know, all available fresh or frozen year-round. And we had a listener, Madeline, that wants to know a little bit about Alaska halibut. What did you find out about that?
She is seeing it quite a bit in the grocery stores now. Mm-hmm. I think now through November, you can still buy wild Alaska halibut. I think we talk a lot about salmon and other fish, as you mentioned. And she just wants to know what your favorite ways are to cook halibut, either at home, on the grill. I mean, we have a little bit left of grilling season, maybe, for some halibut. And what's your favorite cooking tricks?
You can tell Madeline is a summertime griller.
I am.
This guy grills. This guy here. You're looking at him, this guy? I'm a year-round grill man.
I grilled yesterday.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a year-round grill man. Halibut, chef, you know, it's not my go-to fish. I love it. Perfectly delicious. But I'm always trying to manipulate it to give it some more flavor.
Right.
And so how would you add flavor to halibut so that you're not eating just whitefish?
So my favorite way to cook halibut, mainly because also remind...
I should go back on that. I shouldn't say it's not my go-to fish.
Right.
A way to...
Right.
Sorry, Sean, one more time. So halibut, chef, it's thick, it's lovely. You know, the fish are big and the fillets are
thick,
very lean. And you got to be careful not to overcook it because it's
Correct.
Not a fatty fish.
Correct.
Right? So it's a fish that maybe lends itself to poaching. It lends itself to grilling, but you're serving it fairly rare. It's a fish that takes other flavors beautifully. What's your favorite way to cook it?
My favorite way is roasting. I like to roast the halibut, and when I say roasting, I mean baked in the oven, basically.
But you sear it first, right?
I sear it first, mm-hmm. and then I put, what I do is I protect it. I like to protect it. I'm a big fan of putting like olive tapenade or some kind of a layer on top, like sauteed mushroom or whatever, on top of the fish to finish to cook it in the oven so it doesn't become dried out. Because it's so low fat.
Yeah, and because sometimes the fillets are so thick, the outside cooks much more so than the inside you get. So you,
right.
if you're not careful with your cover that you just talked about, you can get a very dry outside and be
Correct.
Raw in the center.
Exactly.
So you would have the right temperature all the way through.
Yeah, you can have a very thick, dry crust and nothing inside that's cooked. So mm-hmm. in order to, and it's not necessarily a fish you want to eat raw. So, you know, it's a fish and I like to cook medium rare to medium. And I like to be translucent in the middle, still have a tiny bit of rawness in the middle, in a small piece, but most of it, I want the pieces to be translucent where they flake out of the fillet, you know, just like normal white fish. And, but I'm a big fan of putting things on top of it before it goes in the oven, just again, to protect it and to give it, it's going to take a little bit longer to cook because now it's got the heat from the top that's not going directly into the fish, but it definitely will cook a lot better as far as I'm concerned. And I do that on my grill a lot. I do the same thing on my grill where I put the halibut. And if you can, keep the skin on. Put it on your grill super hot. Put the halibut on the grill with the topping that you're going to have on the halibut. Put the lid back on your grill. Wait 8 to 10 minutes. Come back. Touch the flakiness of the fish. And then you'll have a beautiful piece of halibut that will have roasted and will have the flavor of the grill as well, which is another characteristic that the fish will definitely take on.
I tend to be a little bit, with halibut for me, I tend to think, one of my favorite adjectives is trashy. So, you know, I love trashy food, right?
Of course.
And so for me, when I think halibut, I tend to think fish and chip, or I think fish tacos. Oh. And I'll take my pork rub, which is more of a Southwest rub, you know, lots of cumin and coriander and smoked chilies and things like that. I'll take my pork rub, put it on the halibut, pan fry that little slices of halibut in bacon fat, just to give it a quick sear, right? So it's still rare in the middle, but just quick sear on the outside because it's only not even a half inch thick. It's about a quarter inch thick.
Right.
So it cooks immediately. And then make my fish tacos out of that. And it's just a delicious way to vehicle for great salsas and good either homemade corn tortillas or just quickly fried ones that you've bought at the store, I don't like fish tacos in raw corn tortillas or raw flour tortillas. To me, they have to be cooked some sort or another.
And also another trick that you need to remember, we keep talking about how thick the halibut is. I have very often butterfly means you're cutting straight in the middle that piece of fish, so the thickness become half as much, and then now you can do a brown butter, like if you have a pan, a sauté pan, you put butter in it, you wait till it turns to the blonde to brown, and then you put your halibut face down into that brown butter for just about 30 seconds, flip it back on the other side, and because the halibut is now a quarter inch instead of an inch and, you know, whatever, a quarter inch instead of half an inch, or vice, you know, whatever that half is, and now you have a piece of fish that cooks a lot faster, so you don't have the dryness happening on the outside versus not cooking on the inside.
Right. Well, if any of you, any of our trusty listeners, love halibut and want a recipe, I have one called pan-roasted halibut with toasted breadcrumb salad and green lentils in my first book, Tom Douglas Seattle Kitchen. And I'm going to send that to the first person who asks for it on our Facebook page at Hot Stove Society Show. Is that okay, Madeline?
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Have to include your address so that we can mail it off to you, or you can come pick it up at the dock in Ballard, 52nd and 14th Avenue Northwest. So pan-roasted halibut with toasted breadcrumb salad and green lentils. Yum. Mm-hmm.
That sounds good. And I do want to add, too, that I know there are a lot of other recipes that can be found at wildalaskaseafood.com.
Cool.
You sent it in.
Up next, we're going to visit mentally some of our favorite cities of the world, since we can't really go physically right now. On Cairo Radio 97.3 FM, it's the Hot Stove Society Show. Welcome back. It's the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo Radio. Tom Douglas here.
And Terry Rotaro, the chef in the hat.
And chef, I know we've been limited in our travels recently for the last 6 months, as a matter of fact.
Yep.
You've gone a few places. I haven't been on a commercial jet since we started all of this. And it got me thinking about cities that I miss, foods that I miss, restaurants that I miss, friends in our business, you know, other chefs that we know around
so
the country.
Many.
So many. And I started thinking about it might be interesting to think about all of the places you and I have been and what we loved about those cities, but then also kind of figure out if we do go back, when we get a chance to go back, where do you go now? On top, some of those places are closed forever, but there's always new restaurants opening. So let's start with New Orleans. What was the last time you were in New Orleans?
I was in New Orleans about a year ago for a dinner for 10 people, and someone bought at the Food Lifeline auction dinner.
Oh, nice.
And they flew me down to New Orleans to do a dinner for 10, then they purchased and bless their heart, a lot of money went to Food Lifeline and feed a lot of people. So I went down there, and that was actually an interesting part because the two time I was in New Orleans before that, I did not cook a meal like that. I was just doing one item for an event. But this time I was doing a full dinner, and of course I took my favorite luggage, which is a cooler. And but going to different places in New Orleans, walking through the French Quarter to me is quite essential New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an air about New Orleans that you don't find anywhere else in this country.
I know. I find myself craving it. It's been so long for me.
It's got that old, kind of almost, I mean, walking from my Airbnb place where I was staying to the French Quarter, which was about a mile.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go through these different smells. You look at those buildings. Some of them are like, you're like, oh my God, this thing is still standing up. I mean, there is so much old history in New Orleans. It is pretty impressive, and it's also very warming to me.
And the history is integrated through the food scene, too.
Oh, yeah.
When you go to places like Central Market, I think that's what it's called, Central Grocery, maybe, and have the muffaletta there. You know, you're in an old building on the corner of an old part of town. When you go to Café du Monde, you know, you feel the history. You're sitting in the history of that
and
city.
Then you're sitting, and you see a boat go about 30 feet up in the air. You're like, wait, what's going on here?
What are you talking about?
Well, the river downtown is like 20 feet above ground, in case you haven't noticed.
I hadn't noticed.
You haven't noticed? Uh-huh. Oh, that's the only place in the world I've ever seen that. And you're looking at a sailboat. You see the sail of a boat go by. Not the sail, but the actual mast. And you see that. And the first time I saw that, I was like, what am I looking at here? This can't possibly be. But that's a trick of New Orleans. And walking through those cobblestone, the old iron, those houses everywhere, and going to places like where Leah Chase used to be, the older lady that used to cook all those jambalaya and very traditional Louisiana dishes. You're sitting in that restaurant shack. It's like, oh my God, you are not in Seattle, Washington. That's for sure.
You know, the last time I was in New Orleans, I tried to go to Antoine's, but they wouldn't let me in.
Why?
Because I was in shorts. And, you know, it's about 1,000 degrees down there with 1,000% humidity. And it never occurred to me to put on long pants and a long shirt or a tie. And that's what you had to have on in order to eat there. And
it's funny because Mr. and Mrs. Reed took me to Antoine. I'd never been.
Uh-huh.
And it was definitely a walk back in the past.
Yes,
the menu
for sure.
Is a walk back. I mean, you and I would relate to our apprenticeship and look at this menu and go, oh, yeah.
Yeah, I know.
Escargot, all those different things are on the menu that menu has not changed for a while. But it is a big, big place. You don't see that from the outside. It's actually an entire block. And that place is busy.
Yeah. I guess I should break down and get with the program, but I never have. I've never been to Antoine's just because of that.
Right.
It's my own foible, I guess, is what you would call that. I look forward to seeing my friend Susan Spicer again. She had the Bayona Grill down there, and we used to do Chefy events around the country all the time. Haven't seen her in years. I look forward to that. Hers was a little bit more modern take on Creole food.
Yeah.
And, of course, since I was there last, Chef Paul has passed away of Kay Paul's, which was one of the first introductions I had to that style of cooking. You know, his cookbook, Louisiana Kitchen, was seminal at the time.
Exactly.
And he was just quite the character. I'd run into Chef Paul at all the fancy food shows because he was selling his Cajun magic, and I was selling my Rub with Love and all those spices to all the grocery buyers around the country. And he'd just sit there at the time. You know, when he first started, he was about 4 feet tall and about 4 feet wide. And he was, I'm not kidding.
I know you're not kidding. I've met him many times. He was definitely as wide as he was tall, yes.
Yeah, and then when I went to his restaurant, he said, oh, you have to go. You know, I can't even do his accent. You have to come to my restaurant. And I went there, and it's just all these, was at that time, all these long tables, kind of communal family style eating. And he just, I think, changed the business a little bit, changed the restaurant business in a good way. He made good food, human food, rather than have some sort of air about it, you know, some sort of fanciness about it. And I loved his restaurants. When I last ate at Emeril's, it was a fairly new restaurant. And I sat at the kitchen counter, and Emeril was the chef.
Yeah. I remember the first time I went to eat at Emeril, and he was on the line.
Yeah, exactly.
That was before he was very famous.
I took my mother-in-law for her 60th birthday, I want to say. That's 25 years ago. And she was so in love with Emeril. And he was just getting on to the Food Network, and right. things were just starting to click for him. And that I remember that well. I went with my Northwest Airlines chef team at one point, and we sought out a soul food restaurant in a different quarter.
Uh-huh.
And literally got chased out of there. People chasing our car, and we had taken a driver and didn't know our way around and got chased out of there. There were some people that would like to have had our wallets.
Wow.
In the certain part of town.
You have to be careful when you're in New Orleans. If you've never been, there are definitely places where you don't belong. I mean, you have to be very careful about where you go,
yep.
especially if you go to the French Quarter. The French Quarter is very delimited. I mean, it's a very well-pronounced area. There are some streets just a couple blocks away you don't want to be on.
Yeah, you don't want to take the wrong turn in some areas. And I don't know if it's still that way, but...
It is still that way.
But that certainly is the case, and that's the case in many American cities.
Yeah, last time I was in New Orleans, when I was doing that dinner, I walked from my Airbnb to the French Quarter.
Mm-hmm.
I was using my phone, and I walked in a street where there was two young ladies sitting on the steps. And my phone wasn't working anymore, my GPS. And I said, the French Quarter, and I said, I was going to go this way. And they go, sir, you go back this way one block and you make a right. And I was like, I can't go that way. They go, do not go that way, go this way. And I was like, wow.
I mean, every city's got their got issues. And so
no, of course,
I would
of
never
course.
Let me stop me from going there. You know,
right.
Seattle struggles with some of those same issues
of
also.
Course,
so,
of course.
I look forward to it. Madeline, you said that you saw some places that are really kind of on your radar of when you go.
It's true.
When was the last time you went?
I have never been to New Orleans.
God.
It's on my bucket list. My husband, Ryan, goes all the time. He does a couple big foodie and cocktail. The big cocktail event is mm-hmm. there every year. So it's on my bucket list. I have never been, but I am drooling right now looking at a couple places that have opened up that is welcomed. We're excited to kind of see what they're doing, one of which is called Palm and Pine. They are just located in the outskirts of the French Quarter, actually, and they have this phenomenal Oaxacan mole dish that is supposed to be to die for. Mm-hmm. So I think we should go give them a try. And then I have been looking at this Gianna restaurant. They're the new restaurant from Donald Link's restaurant group, mm-hmm. who recently opened. Their last restaurant was Pesce down there.
Yeah.
And they are doing sort of rustic Southern Italian food, and the chef is doing that tortellini and brodo. With the broth and some smoked meats and some delicious stuff like that, too. I know there's a new restaurant called Talia that just opened. It's the second restaurant from chefs and owners of Croquette. They're doing a duck confit rigatoni as well. That sounds really good.
It's so
good
funny
right
how
now,
food
so.
Comes and goes.
I
right?
know.
On the original Cafe Sport menu, almost 40 years ago, I had tortellini and brodo on the menu.
Revolutionary. I know.
Yeah.
And now people think
because I had been to
gorgeous.
Italy and I'd had it and I just loved the simplicity of it. And,
absolutely.
And basically it's just tortellini that we made a beautiful, rich chicken stock and just loaded it with some olive oil and some cheese.
Like a chicken soup.
Grated cheese.
And, sounds so good right now.
Lauren Coe and Pyometry is coming up next on the Hot Stove Society Show, Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. All right, we are back in the Hot Stove Society. It's Tom Douglas.
And Thierry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
And you know, Thierry, I have a restaurant called Serious Pie.
Correct.
And I would say, to this day, 15 years later, once a week, once every couple of times a week, we get people walking in and asking for apple pie. Because, you know, in this neck of the woods here in the Northwest, it's not a pizza pie is generally an East Coast term. You know, where you get in Philly or you get into Upper Jersey or New York or something, you're talking about pie. Whereas out here, pie tends to be talked about before Serious Pie. It tends to be talked about as pizza.
Correct.
Or as in sweet pies. So we have a guest coming on the phone. Lauren Coe is here. She's got a new book out called Pyometry. And I have been following her Instagram account for quite a long time. She's as much of an artist as she is a baker. And so we thought we would kind of promote her new book because it's exciting. It's great to have this out there. So welcome to the show, Lauren.
Welcome, Lauren.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
You must be so excited to be here. I mean, to have a new book out. That was a joke.
Both. All excitement all around.
Yeah,
I am
exactly.
super stoked.
So, Lauren, you're a writer, an artist, a self-taught home baker, and the founder of a popular Instagram account called Loco, L-O-K-O Kitchen, with 340,000 followers and growing. You are rocking the world of pie.
wild. I consider myself just a regular person who kind of stumbled into this on accident, and just thrilled to have this opportunity and to be along for the ride.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us about the book. Tell us about some of your favorite pies in the book and where you get your inspirations from.
Yeah, so Pieometry is a full-fledged cookbook. There are 50 pies and tarts in there. There are tart shells, pie dough recipes, 50 fillings, and 50 design tutorials, as well as 250 full-colored photos and, you know, step-by-step instructions on how to create 50 of these pieces of artwork from start to finish. And, you know, we wrote it for professional chefs, home cooks, armchair bakers, and eaters alike. So we like to say that there's a slice for everyone.
Mm-hmm. I must say that when I look at your Instagram account and I look at all your pictures, those look like somebody who's going to be committed to make those pies, because they're pretty and they also, they require a little knife skills.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I think a lot of them look a lot more complicated than they are to actually execute. And we hope that this book shows that I, as a home, you know, home baker can make these. Anybody can in that case. So
that's very cool.
We hope that. Yeah, I hope this book will help people feel empowered to make these in their own home kitchen.
All right, what are some of your favorites? And let's keep going down that path.
Yeah, so there is a white carrot miso pie that I pair with a black sesame crust. That's one of my favorites. One of the big ironies of this whole crazy pie journey is that I don't really have a sweet tooth. I don't love eating pies all that much. So anything that's a little bit less sweet of a dessert, I always reach for. And I also have a number of savory recipes in the book, which I do love savory pies. So there is a butternut bacon mac and cheese pie with a cheddar crust. There's a tomatillo short rib pie with a spinach crust that's really fun. And then we talked about some, like, knife skills and hand-sliced tarts. There is a coffee and cardamom hand-sliced pear tart that I love, both in flavor profile as well as in design.
Let's go back for a second to the spinach crust and that particular pie. Can you kind of tell us from beginning to end? Like, do you start with regular pie dough and add powdered spinach to it? Or, like, how do you get down the path of these pies?
So all of the coloring that I use in my pies and tarts is all natural. I don't use any artificial coloring. So for pie dough specifically, I usually add either vegetable or fruit powder. So in the case of spinach, it's spinach powder. And then instead of the ice water that we use to make pie dough, I just substitute fresh spinach juice. And that the juice and the powder both kind of act to create a really deep and vibrant hue that hopefully stays through baking. You know, using natural coloring, it's a little bit less of an insurance that you'll get quite as vibrant of a hue when it comes out of the oven. But we think that both of them working in tandem give the dough or the crust a really nice coloring and sometimes flavoring, but usually it's mostly just coloring that the vegetable powder and juice wins.
Wow, that sounds really cool. What's the hardest dough that you have in your recipes? Like, what's the most complicated, not hardest, but complicated dough to make with vegetables?
They follow the same formula, so I think they're pretty simple. It's just flour for the savory ones, no sugar. I use an all-butter pie dough and then whatever liquid that you're going to add. So it's all pretty simple. You toss flour, sugar, a little bit of salt, and maybe the fruit or vegetable powder, a couple of tablespoons. Add in your cubed butter, mash that up, and then add your liquid, and then you let it rest in the fridge. So I know pie dough has a kind of a reputation for being finicky and maybe scary to make, but I think the process is pretty simple and the ingredients are straightforward as well.
Let's talk about your book launch for a couple of minutes. You have a virtual book launch event featuring salmon tart recipe demo and book signing with Lauren Coe of the Loco Kitchen. It's Tuesday, October 13th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And it takes place, you're going to do all this work at the Made in Washington Pike Place Market Store, and will be broadcast over Facebook Live. What else are you going to do that day?
Yeah, I'm so thrilled to be partnering with Made in Washington. As you mentioned, I'll be popping up in their store and giving a live demo of my smoked salmon tart. So it's kind of a play on a lox and bagel. There's an everything but the bagel crust with smoked salmon and cream cheese filling. And then we'll be doing an ombre tomato topping. So be walking viewers on how to construct that particular tart. We'll be offering signed books. And I think they're also offering a deal where if you purchase one of their smoked salmon products or one of their products, it comes with a book. So really excited to celebrate here in Seattle and also highlight some local Washington products while we launch this book.
Sounds delicious, and that's quite the deal. A free, just off the press book to go with your smoked salmon boxes sounds like quite the deal.
Yeah, it's a perfect package. And not very many places are offering signed books right now because, you know, the pandemic is kind of inhibiting us from traveling too many places. So it's a good opportunity to grab a signed cookbook for anyone who's interested in that as well.
You're also taking questions, which is something that's hard to do right now. I know we're doing virtual classes here, of which anytime you want to come promote your book here at the Hot Stove, you let me know.
Thank you.
You're able to take questions at this Facebook demo?
I believe so. I think we'll have somebody helping me moderate. So if people are tuning in to view the demo and they want to submit some questions over on Facebook Live, we'll try to get to as many as we can, kind of answer them in real time.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Lauren, I am so excited.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you. And I know that there's a lot of listeners out there who are interested in sort of gaining a little bit of insight on the best photography tips. For, you know, your photographs are beautiful.
Yeah.
And I know that we had someone just send in a note just asking what are some tips on taking photographs of your pies at home or whether it's dessert or anything else? We have about a minute left to chat about that. And I'm just curious if you have any tips for our listeners on how to take those gorgeous photos.
Thank you. I always find this question funny because I feel like I'm just faking it till I make it kind of thing. I take all my photos with my iPhone, and my backdrop is a $5 black chalkboard from Home Depot that I just kind of lay on my dining bench next to a window, and I wing it.
That's awesome.
I would say look for natural light and let your phone do most of the work for you.
Yeah, I think those neutral backgrounds
and find
are
interesting
key.
Subject matter.
Exactly. Yeah, I think those neutral backgrounds are key, and maybe even taking it outside if you can, if you have a cool picnic table or something like that. I know those typically help when we're doing food shots out at the Ballard Warehouse Kitchen, but it's a lot of fun. So your photos are gorgeous. You're making it and faking it.
Thank you.
You're doing a great job all around.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I like how the blackboard the chalkboard soaks up light. It doesn't shine back at you, and that's really an important part
of
this.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Tom's cool. Huge on Instagram, so it's helpful.
Yeah. Anyway, join Lauren for her virtual launch event, her book launch event of the Salmon Tart Recipe Demo and book signing of Lauren Koh at Loko, L-O-K-O Kitchen. It's October 13th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And the event, if you want to go live, I think they're letting a few people in. I want to go live. You can go to the Made in Washington Pike Place Market Store, and it will be broadcast there also. She'll sign some books. So congratulations, Lauren.
Congratulations.
We look forward to your success.
Thank you so much.
Hopefully,
appreciate it.
Hopefully you're going to join us for our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge coming up next.
Yes, I wouldn't miss it.
All right. that's on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's the Hot Stove Society Show. Welcome back. It's the Hot Stove Society Radio Show. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
It's time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. This tasty trivia is brought to you by Rub With Love, my handcrafted versatile rubs, sauces, and mustards that add a flavorful kick and a whole lot of love to just about any meat, fish, or vegetable. And they're interchangeable. You know, you don't have to use steak rub on steak. You can use it on salmon if you want. Look for Rub With Love products in your local grocery stores or butcher shops and find them online at tomdouglas.com. Or go to My Buddy Stan on Amazon, or there's so many places that sell them. We have about 5,000 accounts around the country. Maddie, who's today's lucky winner?
Today's lucky winner is listener Lori Allen, who chimed in on some suggestions with
Lori Allen from San Diego?
Yeah.
Wow.
She's been a very long-time listener.
Yeah.
There you go. She chimed in on some fun suggestions to torture you guys in the next couple weeks. So we wanted to give her a lovely prize.
I used to like Lori Allen.
I know.
And she's going to take home a lovely jar of salmon rub, a boning knife, and plus a copy of Tom's Big Dinners signed by Chef Tom Douglas. Okay, well, we have Lauren here, for the author of Pyometry. She has stuck around to play some trivia, so we're going to do 3 rounds, 5 questions each, and the winner is going to be in charge of shipping this prize package. Whoever answers the most questions right will get official bragging rights, is what we're going to play for. So we're playing for the wonderful Lori, and Terry will be up first with 5 questions, and then we'll go to Lauren, and Tom will be the last 5. So, all right, Terry, your first question.
Go ahead.
In cooking, what do you use a dredger for?
For flour.
Correct. To sprinkle flour or sugar. You can actually use a dredger for sugar if you want. There you go. Well done. In which country did cheesecake originate from?
I was going to say the U.S., but maybe not, because you're asking me the question. It sounds too easy. the U.S.
It's your homeland.
Oh, what?
France.
Cheesecake is from France?
That's what it says.
Sabotage.
You need to have multiple uses for all that cheese.
Yeah, no kidding.
All right. Fruit Loops hooked up with Eggos to make fruit-flavored what?
Waffles.
Correct. Well done.
How much? I had no idea, but I know what Eggos is. That's
How much does a lobster increase in size while molting? 10%, 25%, or 75%?
I would say 25%.
That is correct. They molt 25%.
Chef on a roll. Okay. Chef on a lobster roll.
On the lobster roll, yeah.
Arbequina, gaita, and picoline are all varieties
picholine.
Of what?
Picholine.
Picholine.
Oh, olives.
Oh, I forgot the H on there. Sorry. Yes. It's olives is correct. Well olives. Done. Okay, you received 4 out of 5 correct on that one. Lauren, are you ready?
That's a good week.
Oh, God. It's much better. I feel less ready now.
Much better.
You're going to be great.
Like this, I feel less money now.
All
Lauren,
right.
You just have to walk around for a month with an L on your forehead. That's all, if you lose.
People will just think it's my initial. Yeah. So
oh, that's
fine.
Right.
It's true. It's true. All right. Your first question is, the average Italian eats this many pounds of pasta per year, 20 pounds, 40 pounds, or 60 pounds?
I'm going to go with 60.
That is correct.
Wow.
Well done. The average American Amazing. Only eats about 26 pounds of pasta, in contrast. So
I had that for dinner last night.
I was going to say. All right. You got your first one correct. Okay. Second question. Which spice is added to Spanish chorizo to give it its distinctive flavor?
Pimenton.
Yes, correct. Good. Well done.
I'm so sick of these people that say, I'm going to get everything wrong and they get everything right.
Yeah, I don't know
anything about sabotage.
I don't know nothing except the 5 answers I need.
Well, you never know. Lauren could be just sitting in front of her computer Googling these,
yes,
right?
Ooh, now you're calling her a cheater. That's not nice.
I promise. All
She's
right.
Not.
What is the famous dish that Café du Monde is known for in New Orleans?
Oh, beignets, of course. They're
Lovely.
Delicious.
So good.
And for extra prize money, what do they drink with it?
Chicory coffee.
Oh, yeah. You are so
Ooh.
Good.
Wow, like you get an extra that. Prize.
She's already, yeah. So that she's already.
Now
almost,
I'm hungry, too.
All right. Worldwide, beer is the third most popular drink after what? 2 beverages.
Alcoholic beverages?
Very generic.
Alcoholic beverages?
No, not alcohol. Just
oh, non-alcohol.
In general.
Okay, just beverages.
Wine, and is water a beverage?
Water is a beverage, but it's actually water and tea.
Yeah, I was going to say tea.
Tea is the second largest.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, you still are in the lead with that extra point from Tom, so don't worry. All right, your last question. 50 million pies of this type are baked every year around this season, apple, pumpkin, or pecan?
Around this season being fall?
Correct.
Apple.
Ooh, close. It is pumpkin. 50 million pumpkin pies are baked every year this time. I know. That number surprised me.
I wonder how many pumpkins that is.
It's a lot. All right, Tom, you have 2 minutes here for the last 5 questions. Are you ready?
Well, what did Lauren get first?
She got, technically, she got five out of
five.
With your extra point.
Nice job, Lauren.
Four out of five.
Four out of five.
And of course,
correct.
I got the pie one wrong.
It's true, yeah. So she's still tied with Thierry.
Yeah,
here.
She should lose extra points for getting the pie question wrong.
Okay.
All right, go ahead.
I like it. Okay, Tom, this fruit name derives from the Latin term apple with many seeds.
Apple with many seeds. It's fruit name. Tomatoes.
Pomegranates.
Pomegranates. I should have gotten that.
That's okay. Bananas Foster's was created at what famous New Orleans restaurant?
Foster's.
No.
There is no.
That is not true.
Antoine's.
Nope, it is Brennan's.
Brennan's.
Brennan's flames 35,000 pounds of bananas each year.
I wonder why they're in short supply.
Exactly. Okay, you're 0 for 2. Weird. The Pacific halibut is the world's largest what?
Flatfish. Bottom
that,
fish.
That is correct. Well done. All right. Potatoes are the world's fourth largest what?
World's fourth largest spud.
The answer is crop. Your last question. What is the singular word for spaghetti?
Spaghetti.
Spaghetto. It's time to spaghetti off the air.
If you want to be part of the show and be a loser like me, you can join our community on Facebook at Hot Stove Society Show. You're listening to the Hot Stove Society on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. The show is produced by our team, Madeline Dow Pennington and Amy Richardson. Sound and production by Sean McFadden. And our editor is Sean Don't Call Me Del Torre. Remember, if you miss any episode of our Hot Stove Society show on Cairo, you can listen via podcast. Just subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app.
Thanks for listening and have a fabulous weekend.
And thanks to Lauren, and good luck with pyometry.